The broadcast is now starting. All attendees are in listen-only mode.
All right, hello everybody. Thank you for joining us for this emergency session with the FIA group regarding the reference-based pricing FAQ that was recently released. A lot of people asking us questions. What is the impact of this FAQ on reference-based pricing in general? What does it mean? What do we need to do? Is it going to have any future impact? Does it have any immediate impact on our plans? Hopefully, we're going to address most of the questions you have today. If we create questions that maybe you didn't think of before, or we just don't answer the issues that you have in mind, please, we will provide you with contact information at the end of the session. Feel free to reach out, ask questions. Depending on the nature of the question, either we will address you directly, or we will address the questions en masse via an email or newsletter blast. That is certainly something that we are planning as well. I just want to do a quick introduction. I am Ron Peck. I am Senior Vice President and General Counsel with the FIA Group. With me is John Jablon, attorney and RBP extraordinaire. And with us as well, a guest lecturer, Tim Martin, attorney with Payer Compass, an expert in the field of reference-based pricing, claims pricing, fair market value, data analysis, repricing, and truly a great voice on this topic and someone we're very lucky to have with us for the session today. So thank you very much for joining us, Tim.
Well, thanks for having me.
You bet. Thanks for being had. We're going to go ahead and get started. One of the things I want to mention right off the bat as we proceed to the next slide is that this FAQ is not really anything new. Granted, the date stamped on the FAQ is a recent one. I see the year 2016 there on the tail end. However, reading the FAQ, in particular, Part 31, this FAQ is relating specifically to reference-based pricing. Granted, the FAQ is relatively long, many pages. We're only focusing in on the reference-based pricing provisions or sections. Looking at that, the majority of the FAQ references back to previous FAQ. You might recall back in October of 2014, this very issue was brought up and addressed. There was a lot of disruption and concern regarding reference-based pricing. Is it allowed? What do we need to do in order to avoid some sort of prohibition on assignment of benefits on reference-based pricing? And we addressed it in writing. We had, I think, multiple webinars. John, I think it was a part one, a part two, if I remember correctly. Yeah, that was a good one. You know, there was a lot of noise, and then I think it quieted down. And it's been, what now, a year and a half, almost two at this point. And I have not myself seen any real impact on people's attempts at RBP, RBR, fair market value, repricing. There was a lot of noise, and I think there was actually very little result. And now, a new FAQ is released. It basically says, oh yeah, thanks for the question. Check out our past FAQ for the answer. And we're acting like this is something new. However, it is important that we look at the big picture. We notice that this FAQ certainly has conjured up some concern. It's apparent to me and everyone else that people are still confused. They have questions. Maybe back in October of 2014, they decided, you know what, I have these questions, I have these concerns, but I'm gonna just sit back, see what happens. And now this kind of brings those questions back to the forefront. So if everybody had their answers back in 2014, I don't think we'd be seeing the confusion we're seeing today. So without further ado, let's address this again. To really begin, it's important to understand the different types of reference-based pricing as far as we see it. Now remember, the DOL, the IRS, HHS, all of these administrative regulatory organizations that are releasing FAQs and claiming to set these rules and opinions, they don't necessarily understand the different types of reference-based pricing. So as I go through these definitions, these are based on real-life examples, not on the FAQ. And in fact, what you'll discover as we go through this webinar, it becomes apparent to us that those who wrote the FAQ were specifically targeting the first type that we're about to address here. And by type, first type of RBP plan, this great example is the CalPERS plan, which really got the, I think, the ball rolling back in October and started to create a lot of this chaos, is a plan that actually has a PPO network. They have a network. The patient is showing up for treatment. There's a logo on the card. The provider assumes these claims are in-network. They're ready to process them and be paid the network rate. Lo and behold, the plan unilaterally identifies particular types of claims or services that they are going to pay, not based on the network arrangement, despite the fact that there's a network contract and despite the fact that it's an in-network provider. They're going to pay it based on some reference-based price. The second type is similar, but unlike the first, they make it clear. They advise in writing, on the ID card, in the plan document, in correspondence, that particular types of services are carved out and that the network will not apply. And these second types of plans also, unlike the first, try to remove the provider itself. If they only specialize in this type of treatment that's being carved out, they carve the provider out of the network as well. And for those of you who are listening, obviously the most clear example of the second type is your dialysis carve out, where the plan is paying dialysis claims based on a reference-based price. They seek to carve out the dialysis provider, but they still have a network for everything else.
And thanks, Ron. Before we go on to the next two type of RBP plans, I will also add that with respect to the first type of RBP plan, while we are talking about these plans in the context of reference-based pricing, and of course there's balanced billing and all those concerns that the DOL has, we're also remiss if we don't mention the fact that if a claim is in-network, if it is paid at a rate other than the network rate, there are going to be problems more significant than anything that the DOL is throwing at you. And of course, that's allegations of breaching the PPO contract. So things to consider is that none of these are kind of a one-problem scenarios. I mean, doing one thing wrong can really lead to many more problems down the road.
Right. And, you know, I've been asked in the past, what leads me to believe that, at least the October 2014 FAQ, why do I think they're referring to that first type, the surprise carve-out? It's because in that FAQ, they actually cite a letter that they received from a provider, I believe in California, who had been the victim of that particular type of plan. And in that letter, it basically said, hey, if we have a contract and it says we're supposed to be paid based on one set of rules, and then we get paid less based on reference-based pricing, is that allowed? So that letter, clearly it was being cited in the FAQ back in 2014, was one of the catalysts for the FAQ. So we're not just pulling this out of thin air, folks. This is the real deal. Third type of RBP, now we're talking about what people think of when they think reference-based pricing, right? This is a pure RBP. No network, all providers are fair game, everything is paid based on a fair market assessment by the plan, the claim is repriced, we call it pure RBP. You know, it's been brought to my attention that the use of the P in reference-based price, that for some might be confusing because price is generally going to be set by the provider, whereas the payment or the value is going to be determined by the payer. So again, we're using RBP because it's a phrase that's getting thrown around, but again, semantics, as attorneys we make our living on it, keep that in mind as well. The fourth type, which is the one that's sort of evolving from the third, is where there is no network initially. The plan determines, you know, we can't deal with this type of issue any longer. Too many of our members are being balance billed by physicians, small dollar claims, it's not worth it, let's get a physician-only network. Or, you know, there's one hospital system that we can really come to terms with, but we don't want to be in network with anybody else. Let's get a specialized, narrow network. You know, so where you're using reference-based pricing, but it's underlying some other form of a narrow network, specialty network, physician network, you name it. So now we've covered the four types of RVP that we in the industry are seeing. But as we go through the FAQ next, I think you'll see that those who drafted the FAQ do not understand that there are multiple types of RVP in the industry. John?
Yeah, thanks, Ron. And to underscore the point that Ron just made about a lack of understanding, I am just going to, this slide obviously shows what the actual frequently asked question number 7 in the FAQ Part 31 is. If a non-grandfathered large group market or self-insured group health plan has a pricing structure in which the plan pays a fixed amount, sometimes called a reference price, for a particular procedure, but the plan does not ensure that participants have adequate access to quality providers that will accept the reference price as payment in full, is the plan required to count an individual's out-of-pocket expenses for providers who do not accept the reference price toward the individual's max out-of-pocket limit? Well, that's the question, isn't it? And the emboldened portions here, one of those, adequate access to quality providers, that's something that we're going to be talking about in depth later in the presentation. And then, of course, the last line, toward the individual's max out-of-pocket limit, that's kind of the central question here. And that is what has been scaring a lot of people into thinking that reference-based pricing is illegal or somehow unethical, and you're going to go to prison, and you know it's going to be a whole big problem. So in answer to the question of does it have to be counted toward the individual's max out-of-pocket limit, well, the FAQ seems to say yes, it does. And what we're quoting from the further on in the FAQ, where they actually answer the question here, a plan that merely establishes a reference price without using a reasonable method to ensure adequate access will not be considered to have established a network. Now, like I said, we're going to get more into what a reasonable method is at a later date, but this just, when it talks about ensuring establishing a reference price without using a reasonable method, that is kind of basing it on, as Ron said, an assumption that things are happening that typically are not. And what Ron was mentioning before about that CalPERS is kind of the model upon which the DOL's concerns are all based. This next quote especially tends to underscore that a bit. It talks about a non-grandfathered plan that utilizes reference-based pricing or similar network design. Well, what's a network design? I think that's one of the central questions here. Is reference-based pricing a type of network design? I mean, if by definition reference-based pricing means no network, or at least some versions of reference-based pricing, anyway, mean no network, is saying something is a similar network design a misnomer? Does that even make sense? Let's see. As the only in-network providers, and again, there's concerns about what's in-network. With true, pure reference-based pricing, is anything in-network? Well, I don't know, and apparently neither does the DOL. They have not made it incredibly clear. And this this last emboldened portion here, again, adequate access to quality providers at the reference-based price. That is something that the DOL has reiterated time and time again. They go into a bit more detail about what adequate access means, but at the end of the day, they're really leaving it up in the air, and that's one of the main things that we here today are going to be discussing.
So one of the things that I want everybody to sort of take from this at this point, there are certain key words or key phrases that are repeated over and over and over, and I assume you've noticed that. Even in the question, it's funny, the same phrases are repeated in the question and in the answer. Phrases like fixed amount, when they're talking about what you pay. Particular procedure, when they're talking about against which the RBP pricing applies. Access, acceptance, two phrases John just mentioned. What does it mean to accept reference-based price? What does it mean to have access to a provider? Another thing that kind of jumps out at me, and John mentioned it just now, is the constant referral to reference-based pricing as some sort of a tool or method for creating a network. And not only is it a tool for creating a network, but then it seems to suggest that providers which have agreed to accept the reference price are the only in-network providers. So again, there's this mentality that I'm using reference-based pricing to set fixed amounts, fixed payable amounts, for specific types of claims, that the only providers my members have access to are in-network providers. With in-network provider, meaning a provider who has agreed to accept the reference-based price, and that I will only treat those as the in-network providers and cut access to any other provider. I don't know about you, but the reference-based pricing plans I've seen don't look anything like that. So, like John said, a misnomer, confusion, that's how it seems to me. And speaking of confusion, we're going to go ahead and pass it on to Tim for the next slide.
Yeah, so to just kind of reinforce what you were saying, Ron, so what is exactly a network design, and why do they use the language a particular procedure? And again, this harkens back to that CalPERS-type plan where they have agreements with hospitals to do to be in network, and then they unilaterally enforce a price for a particular procedure. So, for example, with CalPERS, they started off with knee and hip replacements. So they may have had a contract to pay for a knee or a hip for $40,000, and then a patient comes in, has it done, and the reference price is $30,000. Now what do you do with the $10,000 in between? Well, patients were getting stuck with that, or the hospital was getting stuck with that. This really fits the definition of a copayment, which falls under the statutory definition of cost sharing. So that is something that we would look at as being subject to these cost sharing restrictions. And those would have to go against a patient's maximum out of pocket. But when you're talking about something that doesn't even have a network, there's really no distinction between in-network and out-of-network. One of the concerns that the FAQs express repeatedly is that the patient be treated the same in certain situations, whether they're in-network or out-of-network in a reference pricing situation. And as you've said somewhat tangentially, there's really no difference in most of the RBP plans we see. The way the patient is treated is the same. They have the same deductible, the same copay, the same coinsurance. There's no distinction between in and out of network, so everyone is out of network or in network or whatever you want to define it. Since there's not a network, I guess you can call it whatever you want, but there's no distinction in how the patient is treated, so there's no cost-sharing disadvantage to the patient for going to provider A versus provider B.
And so you're saying, Tim, that if I'm a patient, I have access to any provider I want, technically.
Yeah, in theory you do. You can say, I really would like to go to that hospital. You can go to that hospital. Of course, the only question is whether they're going to accept you at that hospital and whether they're going to balance bill you if they do accept you. And then what happens with that balance bill? And so that's probably part of the concerns that the departments have, but they don't really understand it. They don't really know how to treat it. Let's go on to the next one. So in the worst case scenario, the most anti-reference-based pricing interpretation, the plan would have to count any balance billing amounts toward a member's maximum out-of-pocket. But then that raises the question as to what happens to the remainder of the balance bill. So for example, let's go back to this knee replacement thing. A hospital charges $80,000 for it. The contractual allowed amount is $40,000. The reference price is $30,000. So there's a $10,000 gap there. Under this harshest possible interpretation, assuming that the plan has failed to show that it complies with all these other things that we'll get to, The plan pays $30,000. The patient is on the hook for $6,850, but then the plan still has a remaining liability of $3,150. That payment would get the remittance amount to the contractual allowance of $40,000 that the plan had with the hospital to begin with. But if it's pure RBP and there's no contractual allowed amount, does that mean the plan's on the hook for $43,150 in order to bring the remitted amount to the full bill charges? I don't think the departments mean to go that direction. And even if we believe that that in that worst case scenario that that's going to happen, we think there are other answers to this problem, and Ron's going to discuss that in relation to a very recent case that just came up in Virginia.
Thanks, Tim. So it's funny that we mentioned this, because when you think about it, and if you look way back at the question that sort of got this FAQ to look back at the October 2014 and reiterate the rule, and then like Tim just mentioned now, in the worst case scenario, the balance bills amount to the patient counts against the max out-of-pocket. The amount that they can be balance billed is capped at that 6,000 number, and then we're worried, what happens to the remainder of the balance? Does it come back to the plan? But that's funny, because if you think about it, that means we have a concern about patients being balance billed, right? We are worried that patients are going to be balance billed. Well, guess what? Every single plan that I've spoken to varying degrees, regardless of the FAQ, the one hang-up that they have above all else is their concern that the patients are going to be balance billed. So with or without an FAQ, with or without the balance bill counting against the max out-of-pocket, anybody who's involved in any kind of reference-based pricing is already trying to figure out ways to limit or eliminate the balance bill. And let's say the worst possible interpretation of the FAQ is true. And let's say everything that's balance billed to the patient counts against the max out-of-pocket, and thus the most the patient could be balance billed is that 6,000 number, and that the plan is then on the hook for the remainder. Let's say all of that were true. If we take steps to limit or eliminate balance billing, it makes it a non-issue. So that interest that our industry has in limiting or eliminating balance billing, which existed regardless of the FAQ, would address that worst case scenario. And the case in Virginia, which I absolutely love, I'm thinking I should send a six-pack of my favorite beer to this judge, because he's the man. You know, it used to be the judge that found for Tom Brady at the lower level and said that he didn't have to serve the suspension. That used to be my favorite judge. Now this is my new favorite judge. Especially with that Deflategate case being overturned. But anyway, in this instance, and again, this is certainly doesn't represent the majority of decisions precedent today, but based on the philosophy, the legal and political philosophy, we're starting to see sort of a groundswell in general. I wouldn't be surprised to start seeing more cases headed this way. Up until recently, courts, when confronting what a provider charges for a given service or supply, they were afraid to challenge the charge master. Any other form of commerce, real estate, property, consumable goods, automobile, it doesn't matter. You know, if there's no contract in place and I receive something of value from you, the court agrees that I've been unjustly enriched and I owe you payment. But the court looks at external objective evidence to decide what the fair price is. They don't just give you whatever you want. They force me to pay you a fair and reasonable price. And only in healthcare were courts afraid to apply this concept called quantum merit until recently. And in this case, what we see was an out-of-network bill of over $100,000. Yeah, I'm in the wrong business. Now, this RBP plan paid what they thought was the fair value, 27 and change. The hospital balance billed the patient for $80-something thousand. $80,000. If that counted against the patient's max out-of-pocket, yeah, I think they're going to hit that max out-of-pocket, right? Which means another, you know, 70K plus is going to be going back to the plan, right? Wrong. Because the court looked at the case and told the patient, yes, you owe this provider something. The money your plan paid covers most of that fair price. But based on other information available to us, we think that your plan underpaid the provider by $500, give or take. So cut a check for $523, and we're kosher. Guess what? If that $523 counts against this patient's max out-of-pocket, he still hasn't come close to meeting his maximum out-of-pocket, and nothing's gone back to the plan. So this is an ideal scenario. I'm not saying this is going to happen for everybody, but even in the worst-case scenario where the balance does count against the max out-of-pocket, do not jump to the conclusion that the provider is going to get everything they're balance billing, either from the patient or from the plan. John?
Yeah, thanks, Ron. And that actually brings up an interesting point. We have seen more and more reference-based pricing plans, of course, in our capacity as a helper and an advocate for these plans, and of course, a plan drafter as well. We've seen more and more plans who are actually challenging provider payments in court. So if a provider brings a patient to court over a large balance bill or even a small balance bill, the patient with the plan's help can say to that provider, okay, but prove that I owe you this much. What the provider can easily do is prove that it claims that the patient owes that amount. But what the provider has a much harder time doing is justifying why the patient owes that amount. And as courts are now increasingly often making clear, and you know, in that respect, more and more clear, as it were, courts are essentially saying, provider, your bill charge, your charge master, is no longer sufficient for us to just accept as the fair market value. Other factors need to be taken into account. And when we talk about reference-based pricing, one of the things we talk about is making sure that the reference price paid by the plan is reasonable. I mean, you can't just pick literally any number and pay the provider that and say, well, you know, we pay what we want to pay. It's not quite that simple. I mean, if you pay Medicare minus 80%, right, you pay 20% of what Medicare would pay. I highly doubt that any court in the country, no matter what its stance or where it's located, would say that that's a reasonable price to pay the provider. But on the other hand, if you're paying 150% or 175%, as an example, and you know, even lower than that may still be reasonable under the circumstances, but if you're paying something that is objectively reasonable, based in fact, based on objective metrics, then no one in his right mind would say, well, you're being unreasonable. You're paying the provider, you know, even less than its cost to provide the service. No, if you're paying anything even remotely reasonable, it seems nowadays that a provider would be hard-pressed to prove otherwise. Now, what the provider usually charges, usually receives, all that is relevant to a certain extent, and that's where I'm going to get into the concept of accepting the reference price, and that is a term thrown around by the DOL four or five times throughout the question, throughout the answer, throughout prior guidance. The quote is, an adequate number of providers that accept the reference price. Now, the reference price and acceptance, those are interesting concepts. And one is, what exactly is acceptance? Is acceptance accepting it from this plan specifically? Is it accepting it from some plan? I mean, you know, this bullet here, Medicare is a plan too. That couldn't be more true. If a provider accepts a certain amount from Medicare or even from contracted providers, is that provider characterized as a provider that accepts the reference price? Well, we don't know. You know, that's another thing that the DOL has failed to clarify. When the plan talks about its own reference price, whether or not it's accepted is really up to the provider, and it's completely the provider's discretion, and that is something that, you know, obviously plans and advocates for plans are trying to remove from the equation, because when providers unilaterally decide whether they want to accept a price or what price they'll accept, the system kind of falls apart. And as Ron mentioned, this industry is the only industry where fair market value historically has never played a part. I mean, what is that? It doesn't make any sense. Now, though, courts are starting to look at charges and saying that is well above the fair market value. You, provider, would never have required any other payer to pay that. And, you know, I'm not going to get into it here, but there's also a huge issue surrounding insured versus uninsured patients. That has been a huge bane on the court system in the last year or so, where there's significant provider discrimination between uninsured patients and insured patients. And it's one form of discrimination based on the fact that a patient has health insurance. And that's a topic for another day. I'm sure we'll talk about it in future webinars, but it's something else to keep in mind when we talk about provider charge regulation. And we're very far, very, very, very far still from a paradigm where provider charges are actually regulated in any significant manner on, say, a passive basis. But on a proactive basis, if a patient or plan does challenge a provider's charge, certainly not to say that it will be successful, but now at least it may be successful. Whereas, say, 3 years ago, there's no chance. The provider would say, no, it's in the charge master. You have to pay it. But nowadays, courts are more likely to say, this is unfair. And there was unequal bargaining power. There was duress for emergent claims. I mean, all sorts of things go into effect that have historically always applied to contracts, but somehow not in this industry. Now they are starting to apply, and is a very, very, very good thing. Now, accepting the reference price, when we talk about that, if the plan says it will pay 150% of Medicare, the provider, you know, whether or not it accepts that 150% of Medicare is essentially irrelevant from where we believe the DOL is coming from. What we think is, essentially the question is whether there is balanced billing. So the plan says it'll pay 150% of Medicare, but it may have the discretion to negotiate if necessary. If the plan settles with the provider at 200% of Medicare, has the provider accepted the reference price? Technically not, because the reference price is 150% of Medicare. But has the provider accepted something? Absolutely. The whole point is that there's no balanced billing. I mean, if the provider agrees to accept 200% of Medicare, but also balanced bills, well, it's not much of an agreement at all. That's essentially nothing. That's the plan just paying whatever it wants, and the provider saying, okay, I'll balance bill. So if the plan does negotiate and secures a signed agreement or some other sort of agreement, I mean, even, you know, an oral agreement or something in email are very common. If the provider agrees to not balance bill, we have absolutely no reason to think that that does not satisfy the DOL's concern here. The concern is patient balance billing and what happens to those amounts. Well, if there's no balance billing, there's no concern. You know, that's kind of the underlying goal, is to essentially make sure that patients are protected. As long as the plan negotiates or the provider accepts the reference price, or really as long as there's no balance billing, no matter how it's accomplished, our understanding is that the DOL will be happy. Now, a couple of examples here about accepting the reference price, and these examples relate to what we just talked about, or rather what I just talked about. For one example, there's a $50,000 charge by, you know, it doesn't even matter, a hospital, an air ambulance provider, anyone, you know, $50,000 charge. The plan's allowable is $20,000. The reference price is $20,000, less a $5,000 member out-of-pocket. So in other words, the plan is going to literally cut a check for $15,000 with that remainder, that $5,000, the remainder of the plan's allowable coming from the patient who owes that $5,000. So the question of the hour is, how does the plan treat the $30,000 balance? Does it let the patient be balance billed? Does it count it against the patient's max out-of-pocket? Well, that's essentially what the DOL has come out and given us some guidance on. So if the patient's, like Ron said, in an absolute worst-case scenario, if the member's out-of-pocket is met and balance billing does have to count against the out-of-pocket, then yes, the plan is responsible for that $30,000. Now, the question is, does the plan actually have to cut a check for that additional $30,000? Well, probably not. I mean, providers are, even at their most unreasonable, they are still willing to settle to make sure that they get paid. And this FAQ is anything but concrete. There is still a ton left up in the air. And we have still, you know, even approaching 2 years after the initial guidance, we have not seen any providers try to say, the patient's out-of-pocket is met, you have to count balance billed amounts toward that out-of-pocket. I haven't once seen that argument. That's not something apparently that providers have picked up on yet. And, you know, this new FAQ, mainly because we don't see anything major changing, you know, the DOL is just kind of reiterating its prior opinion. And what we've seen in the industry is that folks, including us, are largely not really inferring any major changes. They're basically just seeing, like I said, a reiteration. Well, the plan can always negotiate that $30,000. So if the plan owes $15 and the patient owes $5, there's no harm in the plan saying to the provider, in addition to the $5,000 that the patient owes you, we will pay you $5,000 more than you otherwise would have received. Some providers will say yes, some will say no. If they say no, you can try renegotiating for a slightly higher amount. But at the end of the day, if you get sign-off from a negotiation, the patient will not owe anything additional. Negotiating claims is one major aspect of a successful reference-based pricing. There are certainly plans that will pay, say, 150% of Medicare, not a penny more, under any circumstances. Those are typically the plans that don't use reference-based pricing very long. I mean, simply put, right, it's too rigid to really be effective when it comes to reference-based pricing, simply because the law is not on your side. The law is currently on the provider's side. Money is owed, period. Negotiations have to happen. It's just part of the program. I mean, what we consistently see is that the most successful, the most viable, long-lasting, efficient reference-based pricing programs, plan sponsors and plan administrators are willing to negotiate reasonable amounts in excess of the strict Medicare amount the plan says. And of course, while we're on the topic, that is the reason that's even more important that the plan contain the proper language. For example, giving the plan discretion to negotiate a higher amount when necessary, or giving the plan the discretion to pay any negotiated rate, no matter what it is, even if it is not strictly the reference price. So in this next example, and this is a little more complex, and this was brought up by a client of ours the other day, who is currently logged in, so I think you know who you are. There's a $10,000 charge, give or take a few dollars, but we'll round it to $10,000. The plan's reference-based allowable is $4,000, but the member owes $5,000. In other words, the entire plan allowable is owed by the patient. So the plan negotiates an extra $1,000 to settle because the provider says, we won't accept $4,000, but we'll accept $5,000. Well, great, the plan negotiates that. The total payment is $5,000. Well, remember a minute ago when I said the patient owes $5,000? Well, guess what? To answer the question, can the plan count that $1,000 towards its out-of-pocket? So in other words, if the patient owes $5,000 and the plan owes $5,000, does the plan owe anything? The answer is the plan can apply all of that to the patient's out-of-pocket. Because remember, a negotiated rate and the reference price, for this purpose, they're exactly the same. If the provider accepts the reference price, it's as good as a contract to not balance bill in exchange for receiving that reference price. The same goes for a negotiated rate. If the provider agrees to accept that extra $1,000 and close the account and not balance bill, well, that's in effect the new reference price. There's no difference. Nobody cares whether you call it the reference price or a negotiated rate. If the provider accepts it and does not balance bill, nobody cares. There is no problem whatsoever. But let's talk about practicality here. Yes, the plan can apply it to the member's out-of-pocket because, in fact, the member does owe $5,000. But if you sign a contract with a medical provider and you say, we will pay or you will be paid $1,000 extra, if the provider is then informed that it still has to get money from the patient, oh, it's not going to be happy. I can tell you that from experience. I mean, when you negotiate as a plan, when you negotiate with a provider, the provider fully expects the payment to come in a lump sum from the plan because the plan has deep pockets. The entire reason to negotiate is so the provider doesn't have to go after the patient. Well, if the provider still has to go after the patient, even if it's for a small amount, it is not going to be happy. If you sign an agreement, you need to make sure that the agreement accurately reflects the terms, meaning if it promises that the plan will pay, well, if the patient pays, that's slightly different than what you've agreed. If it promises that, you know, the provider will close the file in exchange for a certain amount, then we're getting a little closer to a place where the patient can pay it. But at the end of the day, no matter what it says, we always advise that you let the provider know exactly what's happening, because the provider expects payment from the plan, and then the plan says, oh, no, 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 it's coming from the patient. The provider is going to be surprised and angry. And with that, I will give it back to Tim Martin.
Okay, thanks, John. So in the event that the harshest possible interpretation of these regulations or these FAQs get applied to a plan, how can the plan deal with it? Well, we think the best way is by establishing a program that adheres to best practices. And those best practices would embrace the five factors that the departments have laid out. They'd address the type of service, which generally refers to a scheduled service versus an emergency service. Use a proactive approach to ensure reasonable access to a wide variety of providers and services. Consider the quality of service when referring patients to providers as part of your patient advocacy program. And engage in a robust exceptions process, which is really about negotiating with providers and many of the things that John just went through. And finally, disclose relevant information to the plan participants so they know what they're getting into and they're well educated about it. They can speak to their providers about it, and they know where to go for help from you. So let's talk about type of service. We could go to the next slide. So this really has to do with a patient's informed choice of provider in non-emergency cases, and then where they can go in emergency cases. So we feel a good patient advocacy program, particularly if it's integrated with medical management, which receives pre-cert requests, provides patients with a good informed choice. That kind of a program would seek out providers who accept the reference price without any trouble. And we've been seeing broader and broader acceptance, particularly among professionals. Even specialists have become more amenable to Medicare Plus rates in recent years. You know, it's been a while since I looked at this, but 3 or 4 years ago, I did some research on this and discovered that the average payment to professionals from all sources was about between 112% of Medicare and 120% of Medicare. So if your plan is paying anything close to that or north of that, you're going to get pretty good acceptance from professionals. For hospital services, some markets are more difficult than others, but we continue to see inroads in markets around the country and wider acceptance from the facility community. For emergency services, this is really almost, it doesn't even need to be addressed by the FAQ, because there's regulation, actual regulation, that already addresses this. It requires payers to pay and providers to accept, without balanced billing, the greater of either the median the plan pays to in-network providers, the amount the plan generally pays for out-of-network services, or Medicare rates. So for those of you keeping score at home, this is actually a codified regulatory requirement you can find in 45 CFR section 147.138, subsection B3I. For RBP plans, the first two amounts are usually going to be the same, the median that the plan pays to in-network providers. Well, RBP plans don't distinguish between in-network and out-of-network. They typically pay a percentage of Medicare, so that would be item number one. Item number two, the amount the plan generally pays to out-of-network services. Again, there's nothing that distinguishes in-network and out-of-network, so that rate's the same. And then number three, Medicare rates, those are typically lower than what reference-based pricing plans pay, so you can toss that one right out. So really, emergency services are already covered by RBP plans and under strict regulation. There's really not a question about what happens there. Really, like the FAQ, this particular regulation about emergency services is concerned that patient cost sharing amounts don't vary when patients have to seek emergency services. They don't like the idea that patients would receive a different treatment when they go have emergency services at a facility that may or may not be an in-network facility. But because RBP plans don't distinguish between the two, it really is a non sequitur for purposes of our discussion here. So I'll hand it back off to you guys.
Well, Tim, all I'm going to do is agree with what you just said. Because, you know, again, I think that when you look at the FAQ, really it comes down to two big concerns, the one that John talked about and the one that you talked about. John talked about balanced billing. Are patients going to be saddled with large dollar amounts balanced bills? Issue number two, are patients going to have access to quality providers? How you define quality, I'll leave that to you. You know, generally, if they have lollipops in the waiting room, that's quality by my book. But, you know, and I think that we've already addressed now, one, if you're taking steps necessary to limit or eliminate balanced billing, and I think the law is even headed there too, and then there are other things to protect or limit, and then there's also actions that we as a plan can take. You're dealing with issue number one. And then issue number two, like you said, if you're allowing patients to visit these places, we're not talking about like an EPO where if you don't go to one of these listed providers, the plan is not going to pay anything. We're not saying that. So this concept of access, I don't know where the term came up. I don't know why it keeps being brought up. I don't know why it's even an issue. Even with the CalPERS scenario, that was more about what they were paying to in-network providers and less to do about a patient's access to providers. There seems to be an obsession with network building and this idea that if you go out of network, for some reason, the plan won't pay anything and you don't have access to that provider. It's very confusing. But that being said, in addition to having access to all providers, a robust program is also going to be able to steer people to the best quality providers that are most likely to accept the plan's payment and limit or avoid entirely balanced billing of the patient, which again makes this into a non-issue. And with that, I'm going to hand it right back to Tim, because who better to talk about quality than Tim?
Okay. So when you're talking about quality standards, you know, again, we feel that a quality patient advocacy program is the best path to get to quality providers. There's a lot of debate about quality measures and how quality is adjudged in the industry, and that could probably occupy 10 more webinars, but we won't go there right now. But what has traditionally happened is PPOs have used complex credentialing systems and processes to help build their network. But credentialing probably doesn't even consider the right factors when it comes to patient care. It's really more concerned with where did the doctor go to school and how many times has a doctor been sued and so forth. What type of specialty is a particular doctor and things like that. That really doesn't delve into any kind of quality measures for the provider. You know, a provider may be located in an area where people just like to sue, or he has to deal or she has to deal with very difficult cases. So that results in a lot of hard outcomes. So what we have been looking to as a way to satisfy dealing with quality standards is the increase in the use of quality standards in the Medicare program itself. For about 10 years now, Medicare has been building in more and more quality measures and has been tying it more and more to payment. As the years have gone on, they always start out saying, okay, we'll give you a bonus if you do quality reporting, or we won't take a reduction from your payment if you do quality reporting. And then that ultimately becomes a program where providers who do well on quality measures get paid more than providers who don't do well on quality measures. So a couple of examples of that for facilities are the readmission reduction program, where the hospitals that measure in the bottom quartile in the country in readmissions within 30 days for the same condition suffer a payment reduction. And then there's the value-based purchasing program, which takes a much deeper dive into quality measures and examines dozens of factors, including three major categories: the clinical process of care, the patient's experience, and outcomes for certain conditions. And of course, Medicare is continuing to expand this into other provider areas. Just a year ago, it started factoring in what it calls a total performance score for renal dialysis facilities. And yes, every year they publish a TPS report. And we're hopeful that everyone puts the right cover sheet on that. So that is one way to look at renal dialysis and quality measures for that. And then just last year, Congress enacted a law, the MACRA law of 2015, that institutes the merit-based incentive payment system for physicians. So physicians, not only have they been reporting quality measures for quite a while now, but very soon, starting next year, these quality measures will begin to affect payment. Nonetheless, a good patient advocacy program will have access to data like this and can use it to factor into decisions about where to deliver care. And then I'll give it back to you guys for the next slide.
Thanks, Tim, and we are in the home stretch here, so I don't want anyone to think that we're going to keep you too long. The exceptions process, we have already talked about this. The primary thing to remember here is that negotiations are absolutely imperative to a successful self-funded plan. Reference-based pricing can add a huge amount of value, but you have to remember that negotiating claims is sometimes necessary. There are some providers who just will not accept the plan's reference price, and when that happens, you cannot let patients get saddled with $80,000, $150,000, $500,000 balance bills. You need to be prepared to negotiate at least some reasonable rate. And lastly, when drafting plan document language, plans need to prioritize payment of a negotiated rate over the reference price. So in other words, if you sign a contract with a provider to pay 200% of Medicare, but your plan says 150% of Medicare, you can't pay 150% of Medicare, because then we're back in the CalPERS dilemma, where there's a contract, but you pay less because you don't think that the contract is reasonable. So lastly, there's just disclosure. And again, that comes down to patient advocacy. And Tim, I'm going to turn this back over to you to just finish up here.
Sure. Yeah, a good patient advocacy program includes upfront member education, and a good member education program includes upfront disclosure of the fact that the plan is paying however it pays, usually a percentage of Medicare. It'll have a list of covered benefits for members to see, and a description of how the overall program works. And upon request, it should include some kind of list of providers who either have said they will accept or have accepted the reference price in the past. And that way, members have a good way to find a provider that they need to find. And just in closing, I'd like to note that, you know, it's important that people understand these facts are not laws and they're not regulation. They're merely guidance about how the Department of Labor, the Department of Health and Human Services, and the Treasury Department intend to interpret already existing laws and regulations. And in the end, we all have to comply with the law, and the Department of Labor and Health and Human Services and Treasury are no exception. So this is just an inkling of their thinking and what directions they're heading. And they're not wrong about a lot of this stuff. We think that these factors that they look at are good components of any good patient advocacy program, and we felt that way for a very long time. So we think it's important to have those things in place. And that's all I've got.
Well, thanks so much. That's all we all got. This is the contact information, again, for questions, concerns. Now we're going to enter into the lightning round. Pew, pew, pew. I'm going to go through the questions that have been entered to the best of my ability, and anything we don't get to here, we'll be sure to address individually and also in writing. One of the questions, is the presentation available? Yes, we will actually be providing copies of the slides, and in addition, you'll be able to access a recording of the webinar so you can relive it again and again from our website. How about reference-based payment for RBP? I like it. You know, I like it because I won't have to actually change any of my marketing materials or any of my RBP t-shirts that I had custom made by keeping the RBP initials. So thanks so much for that idea. Aren't RBP plans, how are they different than the UNC? Don't networks, even if you're in network, aren't they still balanced billing for the out-of-pocket? What's the difference? You know, these are all great comments because you're kind of drawing the parallels between out-of-network and within a PPO and RBP and kind of asking what's the difference. And, you know, I think that the regulators, they're having the same issue because what's happening here, regulators assume, well, everybody has a network, and, you know, when we're talking about balanced billing, we're only talking about out-of-network. If we're talking about out-of-pocket expenses incurred by a patient who goes out-of-network, even though they're part of a PPO plan, these regulators are going to look at that PPO and they're going to ask, is this PPO robust? Does it cover enough? Does it include enough quality providers? And that really is more what the FAQ is talking about. If you told me that this FAQ was actually about PPOs and the balance between in-network providers and out-of-network providers, I think it would make more sense than targeting a non-network RBP plan. So when we talk about the difference, network adequacy is really the key term to keep in mind. When we talk about out-of-network providers in a PPO plan, if someone's balance billed, it will or will not count against their max out-of-pocket, depending on whether that PPO is adequate. Because we're not having a network in the first place, I don't think that adequacy really applies here. In the Virginia case, could you advise what the percentage of Medicare that the plan reimbursed? You know, I don't know specifically, but based on information that I do have, I would have to tell you it's going to range somewhere between 120 and I believe 150 percent of Medicare, more like than not. How are administrators dealing with collections agencies? We're seeing the process and pressure on employers and patients. Yes, indeed. Certainly enough providers want to kind of clean their hands of this and pass it on to somebody who has no scruples calling every hour of the night. There are a few things. We can't go into too great detail. If you're dealing with something like this, I welcome you to contact us. The information is right there in front of you. But the bottom line is there are rules that control when a provider can start balance billing, how a provider can balance bill, when a provider can sell the account receivable to collections agency, how the collections agency can go about doing it, when they need to suspend collections, what actions and what things you can say and do to suspend it, limit it, and perhaps even reverse it. So there are lots of different laws out there, both federal and state, that protect you against collections and balance billing. You just need to know which rules apply, when, how to trigger them, and what your rights are. What about assignment of benefits that you used to promote?
Yes. Assignment of benefits. I still love assignment of benefits.
And the fact of the matter is, either prohibiting assignment and then only granting it to providers who are willing to accept the plan's payment, or vice versa, allowing assignment but treating it as payment in full, and then if someone balance bills, revoking it. You know, those are all in sort of disincentives that you can use to prevent or limit balance billing, which goes right back to what we were saying,
which is that I think this FAQ is less about reference-based pricing and max out-of-pockets and more, hey, plans, if you're going to do this, what are you doing to limit or eliminate
balance billing? Well, that's one thing that we're doing.
If you negotiate, are you setting precedent?
Does negotiating really eliminate the purpose? Certainly, you know,
there are different philosophies regarding the place negotiation has in a reference-based pricing plan. I will tell you that
the plans that I've seen succeeding long-term generally will define the maximum payable amount as the negotiated rate.
And absent a negotiated rate, reference-based pricing is sort of the new
UNC.
But what these plans are doing is rather than utilize a network, they're either negotiating case by case, they have direct contracts. The concern, of course, looking at the FAQ, is at what point are they bumping up against network building, at which point you're playing right into the FAQ and the DOL into their hands. So it is a concern, but you know, ultimately, like I've said before, even if you push up against this FAQ and you're quote-unquote violating the FAQ, ultimately it just means that balance billed amounts are going to count against the max out-of-pocket. But if you're paying the negotiated rate, then there is no max out-of-pocket. And as far as precedent is concerned, I wouldn't worry too much about that. The only precedent that you're creating is that if you negotiate a payment, that you're going to pay that amount. You're not necessarily saying that the amount you negotiated in a specific case applies to all cases, because I'll use the provider's own argument against them. Every case is different, right? Some are more complex than others. Percent most hospitals accept? Gosh, I wish I could tell you there's a magic number. You know, if you pay 1,000% Medicare, I'm sure every provider will accept that, so I could tell you that. But as we try to push down the floor and see how low we can go, play a little bit of RVP limbo, you know, different providers are going to accept different amounts, not only based on geography, but also based on competition, based on the size of the plan and the steerage that they can offer. Are they trying to foster a good relationship with that plan, with that broker, with that TPA? You know, how much value do you bring? Are there other things you can offer in addition to payment, like prompt payment, electronic payment, a liaison in your office? These things are valuable to providers as well. And also, you know, the type of service. Some providers really want to be known as the cardiac experts in the area, and they may be willing to work with you for a better rate if it means that they're going to have more patients and successful outcomes that they could then market. So there's lots of reasons why they may offer a lower percentage. But again, these are all things that you take into mind as you deal with these cases on a case-by-case basis. In addition to that, let's see what other questions we've got here. RVP is a payment system, not a network. Agree or disagree? Yeah, I think that that's kind of the point. And at the same time, you know, you don't see any FAQs indicating that, you know, payment of claims based on a usual customary rate is a form of network. So I again think that the constant reference to RVP as a type of network, you know, it's almost, I think, a misunderstanding. If somebody said, hey, you know, I built a network. I went around to different providers. I offered them a percent of Medicare. The ones that were willing to accept it, I signed on, I contracted, and they are now my network. Well, that's a network. But that would be like saying that, you know, agreeing to a 30% discount is a network. No, it just means if you're part of a network, you've agreed to the 30% discount. So is it a payment or sort of a way of pricing? I agree with that. That's a good way of sort of summarizing that. All right, so it looks like we're out of time at this point. There are a few more questions. I apologize. We've really run up against it, and you've been a great audience. We will go ahead and get these slides saved for you. And again, we appreciate everyone jumping on last minute. It's wonderful having you as our partners, and it's great having a community that sort of just spur of the moment. We can have an emergency webinar about an important topic like this and really get a good dialogue going. And I think that's one of our strengths as an industry, and it's why we're going to succeed. So thank you so much.